I'd like to welcome everyone to this afternoon's session, Anti-Colonial and Post-Colonial Struggles. Unfortunately, our third speaker for today, Xin Lu, is unavailable, sick, and sends apologies, but I hope next conference perhaps we'll see him. But we are very lucky to have Leo Zelik, who is with the Institute of Commonwealth Studies and also a project officer with the Ruth First Papers Project, and which we'll be hearing today. Leo and also his colleagues, we welcome and will be speaking on From London to Maputo, Ruth First and the Failures of Independence. After Leo, we'll be hearing from Pierre Rousseau, who's with the Rousseau. who has been a solidarity activist with struggles in Asia for about 45 years, I believe, and is with the NPA in France, and also on the editorial board of the International Encyclopedia of Revolutions and Protest. And Pierre will be speaking on revolutionary politics and solidarities in the Philippines, from the central Mindanao region of the CPP to the Revolutionary Workers' Party of Mindanao. So we'll have a little bit of extra time, maybe an extra 25 minutes or so for each speaker, and we should have plenty of time then for discussion. So, welcome, Lee.
Okay. If it's slightly disorientating having these photographs clicking by, then let me know and I can turn it off. But these are part of the project, and as Adam mentioned, I'm a project officer involved in at Senate House digitizing the extensive archive of Ruth First's papers that are there, that came after she was assassinated in 1982. I know that another project officer, Matt, is going to talk a little bit about it in the discussion, but this is some of the material that we've gathered in the course of the last year on Ruth First's
Sorry, Leo, maybe, do you want to take that microphone?
Yeah. So I'll just talk about this. Okay. So what I'm going to do is speak for about 20 minutes about some of the key questions that have come up in the work that we've been doing about Ruth First, but specifically work that focuses on her period in exile. There were two periods in exile, one in London from 64 and another when she moved to Maputo in the late 70s from 78. Now, I'm going to try and make it as interesting as possible, but I have to apologize. Most of this presentation I'm actually going to read. There's quite a lot of material that's come out of the archive which I think it's important for us not to miss. It's very hard to know where to begin with Ruth First. 30 years after her murder, and it's the 30th anniversary of her murder in Mozambique in 1982, she was a figure of such extremely grand and impressive research, writing, and activism, forced at a very early stage in her life into radical journalism in the mid-1940s, writing for such newspapers as Fighting Talk, The Guardian. Ruth was a self-constructed Marxist and activist, discovering her own commitment and politics in the 1946 miners' strike as a 21-year-old. And there's a wonderful description of her activism that she wrote in 1965. And she wrote about this miners' strike in 1946. A great squad of volunteers of all colours helped them set up strike headquarters in the most unlikely places, from lodging rooms like the one that I shared with a girlfriend. The handles of duplicating machines were turned through the night. While the early hours before dawn, white volunteers drove cars to the vicinity of the mine compounds. The days of petitions and pleading were well and truly over. When the mine strike was over, I became a journalist. The mine strike of 46 was an absolutely key event in shaping Ruth First's own commitment to the struggle in South Africa, and her understanding also as she was developing herself as a Marxist. She moved into exile in 1964 after a period in prison in 63 under the notorious 90 days rule, and wrote about it in the only book of hers, which is still in print, 117 Days, which was published in 1965. She then goes through a period of what's described as, and she goes through two of these periods in her life, of what's described as retooling. So she transforms herself to become a very different figure, participating in the liberation movement in exile. She becomes a teacher, a consultant, a writer of books, all of which are out of print. And these books consider a variety of different subjects, but some of her most important ones look at post-independent states, principally the failures of national liberation that I'm going to be focusing on today. And then again in 1978, she makes the final move to Maputo and becomes, in freshly independent Mozambique, the director of research at the Centre of African Studies. The final retooling, if you like, in her life. But she's an extraordinarily intriguing figure as an activist in the South African Communist Party and the ANC, because she never hesitated to ask the most major and critical questions of these organisations. A dissident Marxist that her husband Joe Slovo remarked on in 1990 in an interview from a very early age. So what characterised her politics, writing and activism was powerfully summed up in 1984 by Ralph Miliband, when he described her as the least utopian of revolutionaries. A similar statement was made in 82 by Gavin Williams, writing shortly after her murder. She was concerned, first of all, to get the facts, to get to the facts, and to get them right. Not for Ruth was a prior concern with establishing a correct theoretical problematic with which to read the facts. So this is gives you some idea who Ruth First is. What am I going to do? I'm going to focus on Ruth First's outstanding contribution on the question of decolonisation in the speeches and writings that she produced in the period from 64, but also in two books, in The Barrel of a Gun, her famous 1970 book, and in the case study she did on Libya's elusive revolution in 1975, an extraordinary book. I'll also be looking at a number of other things. So this period covers the work in exile from 64, where she also, crucially, was engaged in a debate, a battle, if you like, within the South African Communist Party about the two-stage theory of revolution. And she challenges that notion, religiously held on to by the SACP. But also the development of an analysis that she constructed in the South African Connection, a book about disinvestment and the campaigns for sanctions. I think these three linked elements of Ruth First's work provides us with an incredibly sophisticated understanding of the role of international capitalism in the global south, of class forces, and, as I've said, decolonisation. Now, finally, and I think I'm probably already into my seventh or eighth minute, so premature to talk about the conclusion, but in the traditions of Ruth First's own approach, I'm going to attempt to provide a few fraternal, critical questions and comments that speak to how she was both the most magnificent proponent, activist of South African national liberation, but also constrained and caught up in its own contradictions. So what was Ruth trying to do in The Barrel of a Gun? Some of her targets were quite clear. It was essentially a book that looked at new military coups, but also underlining it, the failures of independence that had unravelled the previous decade, were unravelling, but had unravelled the previous decade in across the continent. Ruth First, in part, analyses the class of petty bourgeoisie. This frequently, as she says, foreign-educated nationalist leaders who are champions and heroes of independence, but also, paradoxically, the grave diggers of the same independence. So Ruth wrote extensively about this class of independence leader who, as she writes, cling with pathetic endeavour to the forms of government transferred to them. So in some senses, I argue, Ruth First used extensive empirical research. In all of the case studies in The Barrel of the Gun, she She carried out field work in Nigeria, in Tanzania, in Sudan. So with extraordinary attention to empirical research, she tests the conclusions in Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth. Fanon, of course, who saw the avarice and the cowardice of what he described as a caste of profiteer, variously described in The Wretched of the Earth, Fanon seizes on and develops his insights of the African elite and writes, "Few of them have read Frantz Fanon, yet they are living out his description of them." So Ruth approached the failures of independence, I think, in two respects. Firstly, she analysed the actual projects that emerged in the 1960s and 70s in Africa, particularly in Libya, but in a whole number of other states in the barrel of the gun. And also the possibility and the celebration and the hope that she expressed for a critical wave of decolonisation that would take place in the 1970s in Portugal's African colonies. And also, she brings an analysis through the concepts of class, race, and state institutions and capital to how independence has failed, how it's been a curse, as she describes it. So The Barrel of the Gun is a fascinating book and an incredibly original one, unusual at the time, in that it looked at the shape of power inside these newly independent states. But it's clear in the correspondence and the papers in the archive that she had started to develop further layers of inquiry and analysis. She envisaged a new book, a companion book to The Barrel of a Gun, that would explain, as she writes, the vulnerability of African independence. In a letter to Jeff Kay in 1968, she explains, "I'm thinking, for instance, of material on the role and functioning in Africa of large corporations and banks, of the role of international agencies like the World Bank and the IMF, the role of public and private loans, and so on. These areas of investigation, centering around a desire to focus on power over Africa, exercised from without, exercised by, as she says, investment capital, credit, trade, and diplomacy. In many ways prefiguring a current discussion about globalization." These were concerns with foreign economic control over the continent. So it was both layers of analysis, the shape of power inside Africa, where she focuses in The Barrel of the Gun of the political dynamics inside newly independent states, and the power over the continent that would give a more nuanced understanding of the failure of independence and national liberation. What first calls in the correspondence with the publisher the general Nkrumah-type study of neocolonialism. I want to focus now a little bit on the work that she did for her book on Libya. And I think this illustrates some of the strengths and contradictions in Ruth's first work. In an interview session with Colonel Gaddafi in July, on July the 2nd, 1971, Ruth questions the structure of the new Libyan government. She asks, "The Arab..." It's fairly impressive that she dared to ask this question, as you'll see. "The Arab Socialist Union is to be constituted with the Revolutionary Command Council as the leading and superior body. How long is this to last? What about a parliament?" Gaddafi evokes the image of a leader trying to meet the demands of the people to demonstrate the approval of the citizens for their government. He responds, "The High Committee may be changed in the future. The people didn't want us to, in the RCC, to surrender authority. I tried. The people also didn't want a parliament. They want the RCC to lead them. It is the wish of our people because they are satisfied." At the centre of this book on Libya, her research highlights the fragility of this so-called revolution from above, led by progressive army officers. Ruth thought that such events, dressed up as popular revolutions, had to be exposed. In the conclusion to her Libya book on the limits of nationalism, she writes, "Like their military counterparts in other third world countries, the Libyan military regime has ambitious plans to develop the economy and more means than most. But the development approach is characteristic of this style of statist technocratic planning. The state is actively to intervene in production and to dominate it. Planning and execution are to be the responsibility of technicians and experts. The masses of people are to be the beneficiaries of an authoritarian paternalism. There is to be no participation or mobilization from below." Incredibly strong indictment. So there is a sense in Ruth First of her writing in this period, very much in the shadow, which she's almost explicit about in The Barrel of a Gun, of Frantz Fanon's 1961 book. But what she manages to do is turn Fanon's brilliant polemical declarations through thorough critical research into an analysis which is well sustained. An analysis that she extends, of course, to the development of the working class in southern Africa, shaped by the migrant labour system, but also in these all-important case studies of independent states in Africa. Okay, I'm going to move on. I've messed this up, haven't I? Just to give you a flavour. So through the work of Ruth First during this period, we can chart a systematic and thorough analysis of decolonisation, also the role that capitalism plays in southern Africa, and how the liberation struggle must proceed. There was a strong sense in the work of Ruth First, that we've seen, of someone pushing and thinking much further than her contemporaries in all sorts of areas, both those in the South African National Liberation Movement, specifically the SACP and the ANC, but also much more widely, asking questions about the nature and failures, often from within, of national liberation in her writing and activism. One of the most famous and important debates that she was engaged in the late 1970s was in the Review of African Political Economy with Archie Mathaju, where she takes on the notion of the two-stage theory of revolution, the idea that national liberation had to proceed through a stagist approach, first achieving national democratic change before socialist goals and aims could be classic Stalinist formulation, socialist goals and construction could take place. So she takes on this theory, junks the SAC in large measure, although with some qualification, she junks the two-stage theory. A struggle for national independence has to be one which takes on and challenges the precepts of capitalism in South Africa in this particular debate. On the questions of disinvestment and sanctions, and this, of course, was an argument from the 1960s, really, in exile in the UK, which was that the more the South African economy grows, the more apartheid will be undermined somehow from within. So it can take place through the operation of international investment. And Ruth debunks this in a co-authored book called The South African Connection with Jonathan Steele, through a very complex and sophisticated analysis of the role of largely British but American investment in South Africa, and also the development of major and multinational South African capitalism. She develops this notion of floating colour bar to debunk this theory. But she also takes on another argument in the book. Despite many liberal defenders then and now who saw the force of change in South Africa being the international campaign for sanctions, she makes a very different point. She says the force to liberate South Africa cannot come from outside, because such freedom has to be won and has to involve the expropriation, as she says in the book, of owners of the means of production and the complete destruction of the state which serves them. And that this, she writes, has to be led by popular forces from below, who will, in the process of engagement and struggle, create new forces for change and also liberate themselves. So developing these themes, which were old ones for Ruth, that she spoke about in detail in talks across the continent and activist work in the UK. So she saw the driving force for national liberation that she states again in the South African Connection and all of her books in this period must not be the petty bourgeoisie, but a long and violent struggle led by the popular forces. And again, like Fanon, she sees the struggle against the petty bourgeoisie as important and necessary, otherwise that national struggle, national liberation, will be somehow frozen and stopped in its tracks. But also crucially, and this is, a key argument, because in the course of struggle, these great new forces will be stirred up. The struggle for decolonization on the continent will involve, in Fanon's words that she cites, the radical mutation of those involved. They rise up and assume new stature. They learn in the process of revolutionary engagement to take charge of themselves. So this struggle must not be constrained, as she writes. Leaving the status quo undisturbed, or in the case of South Africa, in inverted commas, white domination in its most essential aspects would remain and is satisfied with the co-option of a small black elite into the presently forbidden areas of economic and political power. So having said all of that, a celebration and a very important one of Ruth First's work, her understanding of decolonization and independence, she still presents us with a contradiction. While she was both the fierce critic of the South African Communist Party and the ANC, she was, I think, constrained by a certain Marxism that she had learned in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Particularly on the question of agency, that Ruth Woke wrote and spoke about brilliantly at different times in her life. And in these three aspects and elements of her work that I've briefly touched on. So if the working class is the vector of revolutionary change to play a leading role in this process that she describes, in what Marx talked about as the social movement in general, this class seems to be remarkably absent in two senses in some of her work. Her reaction to the two-stage theory, I think, was strained by an ambiguity towards agency. So she argued in her research and activism that national and socialist transformation had to be conducted in a single revolutionary process. Yet among those arguing for a single stage or step in this revolutionary process, there were two potential positions. One saw the revolution undertaken from below, led by the working class and popular forces, not in their name or on behalf of their interests, and not, as Ruth First wrote about Libya, on the basis of status technocratic planning that through the mass of people. And another branch, and another conception of revolutionary change that likewise sees a single and coherent confrontation with capitalism, but one essentially guided from above, privileging the ruling party in the case of Mozambique, where she was deeply involved and implicated, a national liberation movement made up largely of guerrilla fighters, as the instrument of political and socialist transformation, in some ways delivering socialism. At different times, Ruth First seems to hold both positions. Sometimes at the same time, she seems to hold both positions. Even if Ruth First was the ceaseless critic, as she was in Mozambique, and as she was through her life, of this class of petty bourgeois leaders, or petty bourgeois ideology, more accurately, as she describes in the conclusion of her Libya book, and such movements from above, did she not fail to fully separate these very distinct notions of the revolutionary process, these two positions, if you like, of the so-called one-stage theory? So Ruth First fought against nationalist leadership on the one hand, playing this destructive role in the first wave of independence, and she is perhaps the foremost theorist and researcher on that process. On Gaddafi's so-called revolution, her final conclusion is very powerful. The kind of socialist change that she argues for cannot be bureaucratically improvised from above without the mobilization of the masses of the people and without the assertion of their need for social control of the productive forces and political systems of their countries. It is also not a change which can be asserted by military regimes bounded by the ideology and aspirations of petty bourgeois nationalism. However, she threw herself, and it was more systematic in some ways, but she threw herself with extremely brave and great gusto into a project of socialist construction from above in Mozambique under the party regime Frelimo that seemed to typify such noble guerrilla movements. And this is a question, there is a serious question here, because it's exactly such regimes, particularly in the Libya book, that she challenges, and more broadly, of course, in the barrel of a gun. What happens in these regimes...
Just to bore you once more with a slideshow.
What happens to these regimes is brilliantly summed up by a writer at the time. The petty bourgeois guerrilla elite, propelled to power by peasant war, has no choice but the Stalinist option. the struggle for economic growth through the accumulation of capital based on the exploitation of workers and peasants, which in turn means it must consolidate itself as a new ruling class. There are a huge number of varieties and complexities to this, to these arguments, but is this not ultimately the shape that the Frelimo government developed into? So in conclusion, Ruth First had an extraordinary commitment to research and work, to field work, to empirical research, in contrast to the sloganizing of communist parties in the SACP and the dogmas of the nationalist movement that she was so often confronted. The greatest example of this commitment is the work that she did detailing with a team of researchers, detailing the extensive and stubborn problems of development in Mozambique in the late 1970s and early 80s, producing work of an extraordinary important quality and value. Yet, I think we have to be honest that doors remain closed in Ruth's politics. Further, deeper theoretical and historical questions within the broad Marxist tradition remained unanswered. These would have required perhaps a more systematic break with Stalinism, and if not a more utopian Marxism, as Miliband had mentioned, at least a more theoretical and historically inquisitive one. One that was unceasing in its rejection of socialism from above, that she was sometimes the foremost eloquent critic, and the importance also of a consistent application of these agencies of popular forces that she invokes. Marx's own precept that the emancipation of the working class can be accomplished only by the working class itself. The very forces of social change that had turned Ruth First into a Marxist and revolutionary in 1946. A revolutionary guerrilla movement and elite could not accomplish the transformation to socialism that could only be secured, as she writes, in Libya, through the engagement and work of popular forces led by the proletariat. But I suspect that many of my criticisms may seem churlish, even slightly sectarian, since there is so much to celebrate in the life and work of a revolutionary that has been forgotten, or actually not really even forgotten, perhaps subsumed by a institutionalisation of Ruth First as a hero in South Africa's post-1994 ANC-led government. But there's a lot that we can celebrate. In her last years, the refusal to suffer the idiocy of the SACP's, the South African Communist Party's, line, and to disagree and argue in Mozambique with Frelimo's new leadership, while she supported that construction of socialism. There is little doubt that if the South African security services had not murdered her in 1982, she would have become a trenchant critic of the regimes of national liberation in Mozambique and South Africa that she worked tirelessly to come to power and sought to analyse, critique and transform.
Thank you very much, Leo. Yeah. Thank you.